Hello, and welcome to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Szczepańczyk. On today's show, we'll feature two essays which originated on the internet and which have been adapted as radio presentations. The first essay is a story entitled A Day in the Life of Joe Republican. The second is a commentary from ZNet by noted historian Howard Zinn entitled The Optimism of Uncertainty. But first, let's hear these news briefs courtesy of The New Standard. The economy adds fewer jobs than predicted in September 2004. An Illinois eavesdropping law is challenged by a case brought by two filmmakers. An Arizona registrar and news channel lied to quell voter registration. The Department of Veterans Affairs, overwhelmed by wounded veterans returning from Iraq, faces budget cuts in 2005. And an author is ordered to stop selling a book about tax evasion. George W. Bush will face the last month of his re-election campaign with a total job loss of 821,000 since he took office, according to the last Labor Department report before the election. Businesses added just 96,000 new jobs in September, much less than the 150,000 that economists had predicted. The private sector remains reluctant to hire new workers, with government hiring accounting for 37,000 of the new jobs. The unemployment rate also remained at 5.4% last month. Over 200,000 stopped looking for work. Manufacturing continues to be hit hard by the struggling economy, losing 18,000 jobs in September. The service sector continued to add jobs in such categories as professional and business services, financial services, and in leisure and hospitality. Analysts say the economy needs to create about 150,000 new jobs a month to keep pace with population growth. George W. Bush is the first president since the Great Depression to end a term with a jobs deficit. A filmmaker is facing eavesdropping charges after recording police traffic stops in Champaign, Illinois, capturing footage to illuminate how officers interact with the African-American community. Police confiscated some of Patrick Thompson and Martell Miller's footage, as well as the documentary set to air on public access television. Charges have been dropped against Miller and the documentary returned, but charges remain against Thompson. On Wednesday, October 7th, the American Civil Liberties Union filed a court brief to get Thompson's charges dropped as well. Prosecutors charged the men in September, concluding that their videotaping broke the law because they did not obtain permission from their subjects. Adam Schwartz, staff counsel with the ACLU, believes this was an abuse of Illinois's eavesdropping law. When feminist activists at the University of Arizona took up an aggressive voter registration drive on campus in late August, a local TV station's news team paid them a visit and erroneously told them that registering out-of-state students to vote is a felony in the state of Arizona. The station, which is a Fox affiliate but not part of the national Fox News network, used a single individual at the county's registrar's office as a source for the false claims. In fact, as members of the network of feminist student activists already knew, the U.S. Supreme Court has upheld students' rights to register and vote in whatever state they currently reside. The county registrar's office issued a clarifying statement which reflects the Supreme Court ruling, and more than 3 weeks after the incident, the Fox station issued a mixed correction, noting that, quote, state and local authorities can't agree on whether students count as residents, unquote. The correction came just 10 days before the voter registration deadline, but it is not reflected on the version of the original report still headlined on the station's website as, quote, registering to vote could be a felony for some, unquote, where readers are told voter registrations will be cross-checked between states and, if it turns up you're a resident of another state, then you could be prosecuted for fraud. So far, no one at the TV station or registrar's office has been charged by authorities with voter intimidation or disenfranchisement. An influx of injured soldiers and Marines from the U.S. campaigns in Afghanistan and Iraq has swamped that American's veterans' disability benefits and health care systems, already burdened by decades of overloading and a reported backlog of over 300,000 claims, according to a report by The Washington Post. As of August 1st, nearly 150,000 National Guard and Reservist veterans who mobilized to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan had become eligible for health care and benefits. That number will continue to rise as fighting overseas continues. Some veterans have reported long waits and confusing decisions over claims. Nevertheless, George W. Bush's budget for 2005 will cut the Department of Veteran Affairs staff that handles benefits claims, further exacerbating the problem. The most recent figures available show that in April, 26,633 Iraq and Afghanistan veterans had filed benefits claims for service-related disabilities. Over a third of those claims had not been processed, leaving over 9,750 recent veterans without support. A San Francisco appeals judge ruled that Irwin Schiff, a well-known tax evader, cannot sell his book, The Federal Mafia, because it encourages criminal behavior. The court suggested that Schiff could sell his book if he took out the sections on his own tax evasion products and services. The court said that the author made money by selling products that encouraged illegal activities, and that such type of commercial speech is not protected by the Constitution. These brief reports come to us courtesy of The New Standard. We encourage you to support independent, nonprofit, anti-commercial news sources like The New Standard, on the web at newstandardnews.net. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.
The major record labels say that downloading their music from the internet is stealing. But according to these people, making a mixtape for your friend is stealing too. So is making a tape of a radio show. When a rock band plays an AC/DC cover at a bar that doesn't pay ASCAP, that's stealing. When an MC rhymes over a sampled beat, that's stealing. Have you ever sung Happy Birthday to your friend at a restaurant? Watch out, Happy Birthday is copyrighted. So if you're singing in a public place, you'd better be paying royalties, or you'd be stealing music. Does all this stuff about stealing music sound absurd? Would you rather have a world where our music culture wasn't the intellectual property of five corporations? Then stop giving them your money. Don't pay for major label music, and make sure your friends and family don't either. Even better, burn the CDs of the music they like, so they won't even want to buy it. If we pull the plug on the major labels, music gets better. To find out more about what you can do, check out downhillbattle.org.
This is The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Strapinchik. This is the first of two essays which we'll feature on today's show. This essay has made the rounds on the internet, and we've adapted it as a radio presentation. The title is A Day in the Life of Joe Republican. Joe gets up at 6 a.m. and fills his coffee pot with water to prepare his morning coffee. The water is clean and good because some tree-hugging liberal fought for minimum water quality standards. With his first swallow of water, he takes his daily medication. His medications are safe to take because some stupid commie liberal fought to ensure their safety and that they work as advertised. All but $10 of his medications are paid for by his employer's medical plan because some liberal union workers fought their employers for paid medical insurance. Now Joe gets it too. He prepares his morning breakfast, bacon and eggs. Joe's bacon is safe to eat because some girly man liberal fought for laws to regulate the meatpacking industry. In the morning shower, Joe reaches for his shampoo. His bottle is properly labeled with each ingredient and its amount in the total contents because some crybaby liberal fought for his right to know what he was putting on his body and how much it contained. Joe dresses, walks outside, and takes a deep breath. The air he breathes is clean because some environmentalist wacko liberal fought for the laws to stop industries from polluting our air. He walks on the government-provided sidewalk to subway station for his government-subsidized right to work. It saves him considerable money in parking and transportation fees because some fancy-pants liberal fought for affordable public transportation, which gives everyone the opportunity to be a contributor. Joe begins his workday. He has a good job with excellent pay, medical benefits, retirement, paid holidays, and vacation because some lazy liberal union members fought and died for these working standards. Joe's employer pays these standards because Joe's employer doesn't want his employees to call the union. If Joe is hurt on the job or becomes unemployed, he'll get a worker compensation or unemployment check because some stupid liberal didn't think he should lose his home because of his temporary misfortune. It is noontime, and Joe needs to make a bank deposit so he can pay some bills. Joe's deposit is federally insured by the FSLIC because some godless liberal wanted to protect Joe's money from unscrupulous bankers who ruined the banking system before the Great Depression. Joe has to pay his Fannie Mae underwritten mortgage and his below-market federal student loan because some elitist liberal decided that Joe and the government would be better off if he was educated and earned more money over his lifetime. Joe also forgets that in addition to his federally subsidized student loans, he attended a state-funded university. Joe is home from work. He plans to visit his father this evening at his farm home in the country. He gets in his car for the drive. His car is among the safest in the world because some America-hating liberal fought for car safety standards to go along with the taxpayer-funded roads. He arrives at his boyhood home. He was the third generation to live in the house financed by Farmers Home Administration because bankers didn't want to make rural loans. The house didn't have electricity until some big government liberal stuck his nose where it didn't belong and demanded rural electrification. He is happy to see his father, who is now retired. His father lives on Social Security and a union pension because some wine-drinking, cheese-eating liberal made sure he could take care of himself so Joe wouldn't have to. Joe gets back in his car for the ride home and turns on a radio talk show. The radio host keeps saying that liberals are bad and conservatives are good. He doesn't mention that the beloved Republicans have fought against every protection and benefit Joe enjoys throughout his day. Joe agrees. We don't need those big government liberals ruining our lives. After all, I'm a self-made man who believes everyone should take care of themselves just like I have. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. This is the second of two essays featured on today's show. It's a commentary entitled The Optimism of Uncertainty, written by noted historian Howard Zinn, as published on the ZNet website at www.zmag.org on September 30th, 2004. In this awful world where the efforts of caring people often pale in comparison to what is done by those who have power, how do I manage to stay involved and seemingly happy? I am totally confident not that the world will get better, but that we should not give up the game before all the cards have been played. The metaphor is deliberate. Life is a gamble. Not to play is to foreclose any chance of winning. To play, to act, is to create at least a possibility of changing the world. There is a tendency to think that what we see in the present moment will continue. We forget how often we have been astonished by the sudden crumbling of institutions, by extraordinary changes in people's thoughts, by unexpected eruptions of rebellion against tyrannies, by the quick collapse of systems of power that seemed invincible. What leaps out from the history of the past 100 years is its utter unpredictability. A revolution to overthrow the Tsar of Russia in that most sluggish of semi-feudal empires not only startled the most advanced imperial powers, but took Lenin himself by surprise and sent him rushing by train to Petrograd. Who would have predicted the bizarre shifts of World War II, the Nazi-Soviet pact, those embarrassing photos of von Ribbentrop and Molotov shaking hands, and the German army rolling through Russia, apparently invincible, causing colossal casualties, being turned back at the gates of Leningrad on the western edges of Moscow, in the streets of Stalingrad, followed by the defeat of the German army, with Hitler huddled in his Berlin bunker waiting to die. And then the post-war world, taking a shape no one could have drawn in advance. The Chinese Communist Revolution, the tumultuous and violent Cultural Revolution, and then another turnabout, with post-Mao China renouncing its most fervently held ideas and institutions, making overtures to the West, coupling up to capitalist enterprise, perplexing everyone. No one foresaw the disintegration of the old Western empires happening so quickly after the war, or the odd array of societies that would be created in the newly independent nations, from the benign village socialism of Nyeri's Tanzania to the madness of Idi Amin's adjacent Uganda. Spain became an astonishment. I recall a veteran of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade telling me that he could not imagine Spanish fascism being overthrown without another bloody war. But after Franco was gone, a parliamentary democracy came into being, open to socialists, communists, anarchists, everyone. The end of World War II left two superpowers with their respective spheres of influence and control, vying for military and political power. Yet they were unable to control events, even in those parts of the world considered to be their respective spheres of influence. the failure of the Soviet Union to have its way in Afghanistan, its decision to withdraw after almost a decade of ugly intervention, was the most striking evidence that even the possession of thermonuclear weapons does not guarantee domination over a determined population. The United States has faced the same reality. It waged a full-scale war in Indochina, conducting the most brutal bombardment of a tiny peninsula in world history, and yet was forced to withdraw. In the headlines every day, we see other instances of the failure of the presumably powerful over the presumably powerless, as in Brazil, where a grassroots movement of workers and the poor elected a new president pledged to fight destructive corporate power. Looking at this catalog of huge surprises, it's clear that the struggle for justice should never be abandoned because of the apparent overwhelming power of those who have the guns and money and who seem invincible in their determination to hold on to it. That apparent power has, again and again, proved vulnerable to human qualities less measurable than bombs and dollars: moral fervor, determination, unity, organization, sacrifice, wit, ingenuity, courage, patience. Whether by blacks in Alabama and South Africa, peasants in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and Vietnam, or workers and intellectuals in Poland, Hungary, and the Soviet Union itself, no cold calculation of the balance of power need deter people who are persuaded that their cause is just. I have tried hard to match my friends in their pessimism about the world. Is it just my friends? But I keep encountering people who, in spite of all the evidence of terrible things happening everywhere, give me hope. Especially young people, in whom the future rests. Wherever I go, I find such people. And beyond the handful of activists, there seem to be hundreds, thousands more, who are open to unorthodox ideas. But they tend not to know of one another's existence, and so, while they persist, they do so with the desperate patience of Sisyphus endlessly pushing that boulder up the mountain. I try to tell each group that it is not alone, and that the very people who are disheartened by the absence of a national movement are themselves proof of the potential for such a movement. Revolutionary change does not come as one cataclysmic moment, beware of such moments, but as an endless succession of surprises, moving zigzag toward a more decent society. We don't have to engage in grand heroic actions to participate in the process of change. Small acts, when multiplied by millions of people, can transform the world. Even when we don't, quote, win, unquote, there is fun and fulfillment in the fact that we have been involved, with other good people, in something worthwhile. We need hope. An optimist isn't necessarily a blithe, slightly sappy whistler in the dark of our time. To be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, when people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act, and at least the possibility of sending the spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory. You're listening to The Ministry of Truth.